Kodesh Tov, and I give all of you a great deal of credit for being the pioneers. And to those who are still at home, the pleasure to, I think we're, David, we're on live too, is that correct? Okay, so then I say hello to all of you as well, and we look forward to seeing you, Bezras Hashem, in the near future, seeing you personally. We are, I'm going to start off with what might seem to be a strange question, but as we'll discuss, we'll see that it's not really as strange as it sounds. And that is, what exactly is the Seder? And for that matter, what is the Haggadah? And the reason I say this isn't such a strange question is that if you would gather a group of Jews together and ask them that question, I think you would come up with a myriad of answers. Within traditional homes, people would say, well, the Seder is an opportunity for family to come together. It's an opportunity for us to review the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, to connect with our tradition. It's an opportunity for family members from far and near under the best of circumstances, not quite at this point yet, but hopefully soon, to come together. If you start moving outside of the Orthodox community, you find really strange answers. I mean, if you take a look at some of the Haggadot that are now being produced, you have the Hagwarts Haggadah, you have the Haggadah, the Trump Haggadah, the Haggadah of, I just saw there's a Haggadah now of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. You have LGBT Haggadot, you have Haggadot dealing with feminism. You have all sorts of different themes that are ascribed or placed upon the Seder. And I think that that's what's happened over the course of years, even within our own community, is that we've preempted the Haggadah, and we've preempted the Seder, and we turn it into what we want it to be. We turn it into what we think it should be. And the reason that that's really unfortunate is because the Haggadah has a very clear vision of what it is trying to achieve. The Seder evening has a very clear vision, a very clear structure, and very clear set of goals that it wants us to try to accomplish through the evening. If we go look carefully at the original sources concerning the Seder evening, and Haggadah is the guidebook. Haggadah is the guidebook to help the Seder reach those goals. And what we're going to try to do this morning in a very short way is try to capture a sense of that vision, try to capture a sense of what it is that the Seder is really all about. And if we have the time, take a look at how the Haggadah can take us there. A lot of these ideas, this is a bit of an advertisement, a lot of these ideas are in the Haggadah that I produced in much greater depth, but hopefully today you'll get a taste of what it is that we're trying to accomplish. Let's begin by recognizing that there are three fundamental ways in which the Seder can be seen. Three global views of the Seder. The first is halachic. The Seder is the vehicle for the performance of a series of mitzvot that are specific to the Seder night, that are specific to the first night of Pesach. And what the rabbis do is they take these mitzvot, which are independent mitzvot, and they weave them into a structure. So that instead of doing each of these mitzvot separately, they are woven into the structure of the Seder, and that is the Haggadah. So let's take a look in our minds. What are the six mitzvot? Six or seven. I'll show you seven, perhaps. Let's start. There are two biblical mitzvot, and they're on your sheet. The two biblical mitzvot of the Seder evening are the eating of matzah and Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim, the telling of the story of the Exodus. Those two biblical mitzvot were biblical from the outset and remain biblically in force today. Without looking at the sheet for a moment, there's a mitzvah that was transformed, that was originally biblical and now is rabbinic. What mitzvah is that? What? I'm sorry? Oh, you saw it already. All right. I always debate whether to put it on the sheet and ask you but I want you to have the information to take home. I'm not sure you're going to write it down, so I cheated. All right. So the answer is the maror. The maror was originally a biblical mitzvah and is now today only rabbinic. And the reason for that is as follows. The Torah says, when you eat the Pesach sacrifice, al matzos umrorim yochluhu, you should eat it on matzah and moror. The Torah then again commands matzah independently. It never commands moror independently. So therefore, moror is only a biblical mitzvah when you have the Pesach sacrifice. Matzah is a mitzvah with the Pesach sacrifice when you have it, but independently if you don't. Which is why when we get to moror, we say a very interesting paragraph. We eat it. We say, Zecher lemikdosh kihillel, kein hoyah hillel. This is how Hillel used to do it. And what we're really saying is, this mitzvah isn't biblical today. We're doing it as a rabbinic mitzvah. The rabbis came along and said, even though biblically you don't have to eat maror on the Seder night, we're going to mandate its consumption because we want you to remember that it was done. So when we say that paragraph, Zecher lemikdosh kihillel, we're saying we're doing this not because the Torah tells us to. We're doing it because the Torah tells us to listen to the rabbis. And the rabbis tell us to do this. This is a rabbinic mitzvah today. And one day, when we have the Pesach sacrifice again, Be'ezrat Hashem, thank you. One day we'll be able to have it as a biblical mitzvah again. So you have three already, right? We have Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, we have the consumption of matzah, and we have moror. We go to two rabbinic mitzvot. I'm a little out of order here. The two rabbinic mitzvot are Arba Kosot, and Hesebo, Arba Kosot, the four cups of wine, and Hesebo, leaning, and you eat certain things in the meal. Now let's start with the four cups of wine. Both of them are rabbinic mitzvot created to create a sense of what? Freedom. Sense of richness, a sense of ease, a sense of comfort. Wine is perceived as four cups of wine. Four cups of wine are to create a sense of freedom. Now, they are woven. It's interesting. If you take a look, here's an example of how the rabbis weave it into the Seder. The four cups of wine are woven into pivotal moments at the Seder. So that whenever you have a cup of wine, that you're at a turning point in the Seder. You're at the beginning with the Kiddush. You're at the right when you're going to start the meal. You finish Magid is your second cup. The next cup is after the meal, and the next cup is at the end of the Seder. So these are at pivotal moments within the Seder experience, and they remind, there are other reasons for them. The rabbis will say that once you're drinking four cups, they are to remind you of the four different languages of redemption, or the four different redemptions, actually, that you experience as you go through. The rabbis explain that redemption, and this is very important, when we learn the Exodus together here in our Shir, make it very clear that just as slavery, enslavement was a process, it didn't happen overnight, redemption was a process. And it was a process that really didn't fully succeed in that generation. It's only the children who enter the land of Israel. Redemption, so the rabbis say, each cup of wine marks a different step in the redemptive process of Klal Yisrael. And the Netziv, one of the wonderful commentaries, comments, he says, so why do we drink wine to remember the redemptive process? Because each step built on the other. And when you drink wine, it incrementally changes you, dependent on how much you're drinking. But it adds to each step. So therefore, that's wine is the perfect remembrance of those stages of freedom. Question? Can you drink grape juice? The answer is that wine or grape juice are the beverages that should be used for this. There are light wines. There are certainly light grape juice out there. And if you find that let's say you're going to use the grape juice, that that's too sweet, then I would put a little bit of water in it to dilute it. But you can get by with that. I'll talk with you about the specifics afterwards if you want, but that's the global answer. Okay? All right, so the four cups of wine, therefore, are again, they're an independent mitzvah. They're not independently commanded you should have four cups of wine on the night of the Seder, but they're woven into the Seder experience. Hesebo, on the night of the Seder, you're supposed to eat leaning. This is, again, woven into the context of the Seder. Okay, you know what? Let's hold all the questions till the end. I'll leave time. Okay, just write it down for yourself and I'll leave time because otherwise we won't get through. Thank you. All right, so a transform mitzvah we got. Now there's a mitzvah of debated origin, and that is the mitzvah of reciting Hallel on the Seder night. Some say it's a biblical mitzvah, some say it's a rabbinic mitzvah. But it is one of the fundamental mitzvot of the evening. And finally, a questionable mitzvah. Questionable mitzvah is charoset. Charoset is mentioned in the Mishnah, that mixture of apples and nuts and wine that we make. Some authorities refer to it as a mitzvah, that it's a mitzvah to have charoset. Others say it's a minhag. And therefore, it's questionable whether it rises to the stature of a mitzvah. Those who say it's a minhag say actually it's supposed to counteract the wine. It's supposed to, so therefore it's to keep you healthy. So one way or the other, that's a good an answer, something of an answer, the recognition of your question, of your issue. So therefore, what we have at this level, just at this level, the Seder technically is a vehicle. It's a vehicle in which we take a series of mitzvot that we are supposed to perform on the Seder night, and we weave them into a coherent structure. So you're not just going to do them separately, you're going to weave them into that coherent structure, and that structure provides you with this entity known as the Seder, that within which you will perform these mitzvot. There are other mitzvot you're going to perform during the night, but they're not specific to the night, like benching, like birkat hamazon, like washing your hands for hamotzi. I'm not referring to all those. But these are the six or seven critical mitzvot of the evening. Let's go to level number two. Level number two is the Seder is a recreation of one particular moment in history. You're reliving a moment in history. What moment in history is that? What, I'm sorry? Okay, good, thanks. You all gave me the answer I expected, so I can say that you're all not 100% right. All right, the answer is that I usually get, and I'll repeat this for the listeners at home, the answer I usually get to that question is, what the moment you're re-experiencing is the moment of Yetziat Mitzrayim. No, because if you were re-experiencing the moment of Yetziat Mitzrayim, you would be having the Seder around 12 o'clock the next day. Yetziat Mitzrayim takes place in the middle of the first day, in the middle of the first day of Pesach. In fact, what happens historically is Paro comes to Moshe in the middle of the night and says to him, after Makas Bechoros, he says, get out of here, you're out, I want you to go, finally, go, goodbye. And all of a sudden Moshe says, not so fast. We're not going to go out like thieves in the night. We're not going to leave after centuries of slavery sneaking out. We're going to go in the middle of the day with our heads held high. We're going to march out like an army, and you're all going to watch us. And Yetziat Mitzrayim takes place, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, the Torah says, in the middle, whatever was halachic midday of that day. So that's not what we're experiencing. We're experiencing the night before. What we are re-experiencing is the night before the Exodus, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I want you, he says a few days earlier, I want you to take a seh, I want you to take a sheep or a goat, and I want you to slaughter it, and I want you to eat it within the context of your homes, place blood on the doorposts, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what you're going to do the night before the Exodus. And it is that Karbon Pesach, actually the first concept of a Karbon in Jewish thought that is mandated, it is that Karbon Pesach that we are re-experiencing on the Seder night. Celebrate avot, celebrate, the rabbi, the Torah says, take a seh for the home of the fathers, gather together, create a group, sit down and eat this meal. And the question, of course, is, you gave a good answer. It's not that your answer wasn't right. Why aren't we re-experiencing Yetziat Mitzrayim? Why, if we want to re-experience the Exodus, recall the Exodus, are we re-experiencing the night before? Why is that so critical? So there are three answers that I would give to you. And they're there on the bottom of the page. If you look at the middle of the page, the historical, the recreation of the powerful moment, which is the Karbon Pesach. Number one, in Jewish thought, there are two words for freedom. There is dror and there is chirut. Dror means liberty. Where do we have that pasuk? We have that pasuk in Parshas Bahar with the Yovel year, where the Torah says, "Ukrasem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveho." You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land on the Yovel year, the Jubilee year, unto all its inhabitants. I'll tell you something interesting. That phrase, "You shall proclaim liberty unto the land unto all the inhabitants thereof," is inscribed on the Liberty Bell. I asked that question a few years ago to my students at Yeshiva University. The only one who knew the answer was a Canadian. All right, so we're not teaching our history well. All right, but what is dror? Dror is what is liberty? Liberty is something that is granted to you by someone else. It's the removal of the external restraints upon your freedom. When we free the slaves on the Yovel year, what are we doing? We're proclaiming liberty. We're saying you can go. We're removing the constraints. Chirut is very different. That's the second word for freedom. Chirut means freedom. Freedom means a life of meaning. Freedom means doing what is important to you within your life, being free to do that and proclaiming that freedom. The rabbis will say that the words of the Torah, the Ten Commandments, were charut al haluchot, engraved on the, and they play on the word, they say, al tikra charut elo chirut. Don't call it charut, don't call it free, don't call it engraved, call it freedom. She'ein lecha ben chorin, Ela Misha Osek BaTorah. Because from a Jewish perspective, the only one who's truly free is someone involved in Torah. What does that mean? It's kind of strange. It means that Torah frees us from what enslaves us in the world. It gives us the ability to move beyond the shackles that enslave us and that hold us back. When I'm involved in Torah, when I'm involved in working and worshiping Hashem, I'm basically saying that all the things that everybody else thinks are so important are important perhaps, but not the most important. Wealth, riches, all the things that everybody's a slave to today, right? We're ourselves. Now, what was the moment? I know what the moment of dror was. I know what the moment of liberty was. The moment of liberty was when the Jews marched out of Egypt. That's when they achieved liberty. That's when they were able to throw off the shackles. But when did they achieve chirut? And the answer would be the night before. Because what did they do that night that we're recreating? What they did that night that we're recreating is they basically turned to Egypt and they took an Egyptian god, according to Chazal, and they said, "We're going to use it for our korban. We are free from you. In the dark, you think we're still slaves? We're not slaves anymore. We're going to be free." And they proclaimed their freedom in the darkness of the night around the family table. That's powerful. And they said to Egypt, you can't enslave us. And what they did at that moment is they created a paradigm. How many times across the face of history have Jews had to proclaim their freedom against the darkness of persecution? How many times, how many stories do we hear? I saw it myself. I visited the ex-Soviet Union before Glasnost, and I visited some refuseniks. And they looked at us and they said to us, "We are the only free people in the Soviet Union." And I said, what do you mean you're the free people? You can't work. You're We're free. We're doing what we want to do. We're doing what we think is important. We're not bound by them. And that's why this moment is so critical on this level. Because what's happening is on the Korban Pesach is when we become free. We're not at liberty yet. And it teaches us two things. It teaches us that you can be free but not at liberty. It also teaches us the reverse. You can be at liberty and not be free. And one of the things that's fascinating, I find, look, I come from America. I don't know how many of you are United States, some of you from elsewhere. But the studies that have been done, America is the freest country in the world in some ways, right? It's most liberty, most human rights, and yet has so many unhappy people. They do studies and they find that people aren't happy. And it has to do with this issue of being at liberty but not being free. Being free is finding something meaningful. Being free is filling your life with meaning and significance. And in our case, that's Torah. So we celebrate the night before the Exodus because that's the moment of Chirut. That's the moment of freedom. Next, if you look carefully at the Korban Pesach, you find that the foundations of our survival as a nation are embedded in it. This is the first ritual, as you were, that we're being told to do. Number one, read it with me. Dabru el b'nei Yisrael le'mor be'asor l'chodesh, on the 10th day. You can read it in the English if you want. V'yikhu lachem ish sel le'beit avot sel la'bayit. Family. There is the first foundation of our survival as a people is the family. The single most important educational unit in Judaism is the family. And what Hashem is saying to us is, you're going to be born as a nation tomorrow, but I don't want you having constitutional conventions, and I don't want you out proclaiming anything in the streets, and I don't want you riding up and having mass rallies. What do I want you to do? Go home and have a family meal. Have a family meal. That is what the Korban Pesach is. It's a family meal. And as we're sitting there, Hashem is saying to us, strengthen those bonds. Family. Celebrate Avot, nuclear family. Celebrate nuclear family. Celebrate Avot, extended family. One of the things that the Holocaust robbed so many families of were grandparents. The ability to have that extended family. It's coming back again. And even though we have it now, we're so spread out, we don't spend enough time cementing those bonds. How it used to be when you used to live in the shtetl with all the difficulties, you had the uncles there and the aunts there and the cousins there and the grand. Now extended family spread out. But this concept of family as the single most important unit in Jewish survival is of paramount importance. It's more important than the school. It's more important than the shul. And I say that as someone who dedicated his life to the rabbinate. And how many times, if someone says to me, what's the greatest failing of American Jewry? So the answer is assimilation. But assimilation is not the failure. That's the symptom. To me, it's the abdication of the family unit as the primary educational institution in education. When we abdicate that, and certainly in the non-traditional communities, when we abdicate that to the Talmud Torah or to something else, and I taught in Talmud Torah, parents would come and say, well, we don't do that, but you teach to the kids, you're fighting a battle that you can't win. And even in the Orthodox community, when parents would come to me and say, I want the school to teach my child not to cheat. No, no, no. The school should enforce no cheating, but you should teach your child not to cheat. And I had extremely honest parents, Aleihem HaShalom. But I still remember the time that they asked me to go when I was 12 under the turnstile, right? For one more time, right? And I turned to them and I said, but Mom, Dad, that's lying. And they said, you're right, you're 100%. But if we do that, if we have the kid go, if we say, make believe you're two and when you're five or whatever it may be, then we're teaching the child to cheat. And we, if we don't sit down to learn, then we're teaching the child that learning is good for children, but not for adults. Look at all the lessons we teach in the family. So that's where this starts. So God is saying on your national, why do I want you to, how do I want you to mark your national birth? With a return to the family. Next. Vim yimad habayis mios miseh. If you can't, if what you do is you set up a chabura with your family, a special unit, and that unit is supposed to consume this sacrifice. Now let's say you're, it's too small a family. So what do? V'lokachu u'shcheino ha'karov el beito. Then what you do is you get together with your neighbor. Now what does the word shachein mean? Shachein means neighbor. So the Torah is using superfluous words here. Ha'shochein karov el beito, near to your house. Well, by definition, if it's my neighbor, he's near to my house. You should feel them near to your house. That's the next stage. The next stage is community. You start with family, you move to community, community sharing. I can't do it alone. I need your help. But then, what does the Torah do? It ends that sentence, Ish lefi achlo tachosu al haseh. Every person has to eat his or her part. Sometimes we can use family and community as excuses for not doing our own responsibility, right? I've got the crowd. Someone will take care of it. That's someone else's job. Along comes the Torah and says, family, community, individual responsibility. So you see how woven into the fabric of the ritual that's taking place on the night before the birth of our nation are the very foundations upon which that nation has to stand. It has to stand on family, community, and personal responsibility. But then you get to the last line I quoted. It's actually a line that comes a few sentences later. V'kacha tochlu oso. Masnechem chagurim na'alechem baraglechem umakelchem biyedchem. And this is how you should eat this sacrifice. Ready to move with your staffs in your hand. This is literal. Sit at the table with the staffs in your hand, your shoes girded for the journey, ready to move. And you could almost say, well, that's a little ridiculous. It's a good way to get indigestion. Let me pack and then I'll eat. Let me eat and then I'll pack. I mean, what are you having me do? So the rabbis look at this and they make a strange comment. They say, Mikan derech eretz li'ovrei derachim sheyu mezurazim. From here you learn a good advice to travelers. Be prepared. And you look at this and you say, what is this, the Boy Scout motto? I don't understand. What are the rabbis teaching me? But it is such a brilliant observation. And then you see the picture of the Korban Pesach in your mind and you realize how powerful that observation is. What the rabbis are saying is, you know what? You're beginning a journey. Who are the travelers? The travelers are Kal Yisrael across the face of history. And these are the first steps. These are the first steps of your national journey. Everything that came before this was prehistory. The patriarchal era is pre-national. These are the first steps of your national journey. And if you want to survive, be prepared. Be roa es hanolad. If you want to survive, look at what's going on around you and recognize it and be prepared to travel. Be prepared for the journey if you have to journey. Famous story. Famous story of a probably not true, but it makes the point so clearly, of an eye doctor in the 1930s in Germany. And he sees what's happening. And he decides to make aliyah. And he puts a sign outside his office. And he says, I'm leaving for Israel. For all of you who are nearsighted, there is a doctor around the corner. For all of you who are farsighted, follow me. And, you know, and it's easy to say, look, it's easy to say, we weren't there, and who knows what's happening now in Europe and America and what the signs are, and maybe we're going to look back and say, why didn't you get out of there when you could have then, in all of these countries. But the point is that this is a survival technique for Jewish life, built into these very first steps. Be ready for the journey. Be ready to move. Be ready to do what you need to do. And movement can be physical. Movement can be spiritual. Do what you need to do to be sure that tomorrow you're going to survive. Ezehu chacham haroes hanolad, the rabbis say. Any who's wise, the person who sees what's aborning, the person who sees what's coming, what's being born now. And if you look at our world, the ability to predict what's going to happen tomorrow? Can't. It's just try, but we have to try. But we have to try. Because if we can't do that, then we're going to be in trouble. We've got to, and that's what all the things that we're doing, all the machinations, is to try to say what's happening tomorrow and how can we succeed. So for all of these reasons, and I would think perhaps for more reasons, this is the moment that we recreated the Seder night. The moment not of the Exodus, but the moment before the Exodus. To remind us of the difference between slavery and freedom, to remind us of the structures that will preserve us, particularly beginning with family, and to remind us to always be ready for the thing that's going to happen next. Finally, we come to the last part, last global view of the Seder. And I think that in many ways, this is the most important. Again, the first two, Seder is a vehicle for the performance of mitzvot, woven together. Number two, it's a recreation of one historical moment. But then the Seder is something else. And what I want you to do is I want you to turn the page for a minute. And I want you to look at the structure of the Seder. As I outlined it, it's familiar to us. Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, etc. But you see that I've divided them into sections, and let me explain why. At face value, the Seder is a very strange structure. We do ritual. We stop to eat, and then we do ritual again. So in other words, a Seder can be divided into three parts: before the meal, and after the meal, which defines the Jewish life. But aside from that, all right, but that the structure is before the meal, after the meal, and after the meal. Now, if you were creating this structure from the beginning, you might have done it differently. I might have done it differently. Maybe I would have put all the ritual first and then, okay, now we can have the meal. Or maybe I would have said, okay, let's have the meal and get to the ritual. But why do we take the ritual and put it smack dab into the middle of the meal? And I'm going to make it even more difficult. We not only put it in the middle of the meal, we not only put the meal in the middle of the Seder, we put it in the middle of Hallel. Hallel is broken into two parts. What we normally say, the Hallel we said today for Rosh Chodesh, is broken into two parts. One part comes before the meal, and one comes after the meal. And the question, of course, is why is the structure as it is? And the answer, I believe, is, and I have it here, is after you get through the setting the stage, which is Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, those are events, the rabbis say, that are to cause, aside from Kiddush, you're doing things to cause questions on the part of the children. Everything in Unit 2 deals with the past. Everything in Unit 3, Rachtza, motzi matza, everything surrounding the meal deals with the present. And the ritual that follows the meal, even that second half of Hallel, that deals with the future. And therefore, if you look at the structure of the Seder, it's not only recreating one particular moment in history, but it is trying to capture the entire flow of history, past, present, future. And I want to read to you something that is so beautiful from Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik says that there are three aspects to a Jew's time awareness. You don't have it on your sheets. I'm going to read it to you. He speaks in terms of three different time awarenesses: retrospection, anticipation, and appreciation. He says, retrospection, and let me read you his words, refers to a man's ability to re-experience the past, to feel deeply that which is only a memory, to transport an event of the distant past into a creative, living experience of the present. This first step, this first aspect of time awareness is to live the past in our lives. And you know what? We Jews do that like no one else. We carry the past with us, on our shoulders. And this isn't a coincidence. This is who we are. We believe that the past lives in us. When the Torah creates, when our history creates a patriarchal era and then the nation is born, one of the reasons for that is when the nation is born, it's not born in a vacuum. It becomes a nation born with a past, right? It's a new nation born with a past, born with the patriarchal era. And when we go to Eretz Yisrael, we're not just going to a land that's being given to us. It's a land that was given to our fathers. How much more significant is that? You find a beautiful necklace in a jewelry box and you say, oh, that was my grandmother's. How much more beautiful it suddenly just became, right? This adds such dimension to our lives. And we carry the past with us, and it's part of our lives. And in fact, when the Jews go into Eretz Israel and the land is divided, the Torah does something very strange. It doesn't just divide it. The formula for the division of the land doesn't just depend on the Jews who have come in. It's divided in a way that also counts the people who left Egypt and never made it. You've got to divide it and then go back to that generation and divide it again. It's very complicated. But the reason is because when I'm going into the land with Yoshua, I'm not going in alone. I'm carrying in my parents who couldn't make it. And when we came to Israel ourselves, now in our day, how many Jews did we carry with us? How many souls? How many centuries of souls of Jews who wanted and dreamt of being here, who we are now fulfilling their dream, not just for us, but for them as well. That's retrospection. Anticipation. Anticipation is man's projection of visions. I'm reading the words of the Rav, and aspirations into the future. Indeed, his present life is regulated in expectation of the fulfillment of this dream. His present is shaped by his vision of the future. The Rav says that the contribution that the Jewish people made to historical thought was that we contributed the concept of a destiny-driven history. What's a destiny-driven history? It's a history that's going somewhere, right? Until then, everybody said, history, it's just a bunch of things that happened, propelled by what's happened in the past. Along come the Jews and say, no, we're going somewhere. We're going. We call it the Messianic era. We call it Mashiach. We're not quite sure what it is. We have all sorts of different visions, but you know what? We're going there. And that's anticipation. Recognizing that you're traveling to a particular goal. And then finally, there's appreciation. Appreciation embraces the present as a precious possession, as inherently worthy. These are the Rav's words. Retrospection and anticipation are significant, this is very important, only insofar as they transform the present. In every fraction of a second, visions can be realized or destroyed. Says the Rav, the last piece is appreciation of our own time. And by the way, this is the hardest. This is the hardest. To feel the past, to carry the past, to see, say, oh yes, I've got some future dreams, but to see the importance of the time in which you live, to say to yourself, how will history books write up this generation? What will they say about us? Where did we succeed? Where did we fail? And along says the Rav, and the Rav says that that appreciation gives life to the other two. That retrospection and anticipation are only significant, he says, if they transform your present. Carrying the past is not enough. The past has to change your present. Dreaming of Mashiach isn't enough. That has to change your actions today. Now let's go back to the Seder. Everything before the meal is the past. Everything after the meal is the future. That meal that I eat is like no other meal in my experience, if I'm doing it right. That meal is the time when I should be speaking about the appreciation. That's the, I'm eating a meal surrounded, literally surrounded by my history, past and future. And what I should be doing during that time is thinking and talking. Well, what about us? What about us? What about us? What about the Jews out? What about the Jews in exile? What about the Jews in Israel? What about our role? What should we do? How should we do it? What should it be? And therefore, seen this way, the Seder becomes much more than just simply a family meal or an opportunity to come together. It's much more than simply remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is the ultimate goal of the Seder. The ultimate goal of the Seder is to sensitize us to our historical process, and more than that, to inject us into its flow. There, I should come out feeling I'm a player. My family, we're players. We're players in this historical saga. We're part of it. That's why, for example, the whole concept is v'higadeta levincha. You have to be part of this. You have to perpetuate it. It has to be part of this whole, it's all structured to make us feel that we are participants in the process. And we're going to run out of time, but I want you to turn for just a moment to the last sheet on your page. And this is a whole session unto itself, but I'm going to be very, very quick here. You can't accomplish the Seder's goal in a vacuum. The Seder has to lead you there. We can't live the lives we live and do all the things we do and then all of a sudden switch a button and say, okay, tonight I'm going to feel like I'm part of Jewish history. And therefore, what the Seder does, and this is brilliant, is it creates the mitzvah of Magid. Now, the mitzvah of Magid is in the Torah. Magid is, it's a biblical commandment. Tell over the story of the Exodus. But the way the Mishnah structures, here's where the Haggadah becomes the guidebook. Magid in the Haggadah comes from the time of the Mishnah. It's already actually preceded. The Mishnah was recorded in the year 200 of the Common Era, but already this was known, so it could be recorded. There are three steps in Magid. One is Matkil Beginut Umesayim Beshvach. It's at the top of your page. You start with the negative and you go to the positive. The second stage is V'doresh Me'arami Oved Avi Ad Sheyigmar Kol HaParsha Kula. The second stage is we learn a section of Torah text. And the third stage is Rabban Gamliel Hoya Omer. Rabban Gamliel said you can't fulfill the evening unless you've spoken about Pesach, Matzah, and Morah. Those are three steps. I need more time for this than I have. each of those steps us towards where we need to be vis-a-vis Jewish history. The first step, Maschil Begnus U'Mesayim B'Shvach, is a step that creates historical awareness. The awareness of the flow of Jewish history. That's what we tell over in the Exodus, but we don't just start the Exodus history to when we were idolaters and now. And it basically says you start with the negative and you move to the positive. That line, you start with, summarizes Jewish history in totality. It's not just a statement about Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're going somewhere. That's historical awareness. And it does it by, and I've given you sources here to tell you where, and this is a whole side that goes aside and then comes back to the central folk. But the two, three important paragraphs in this first stage are really the Manishtano, the answer Avodim Hayinu, which is the first answer to the Manishtano, and a few pages later, the answer Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zara Hayu Avoseinu, we were once idolaters, that's the second answer to the Manishtano. Those are the primary passages. That's what I would call the primary flow of that section. In between, you have a whole bunch of Maisalach, which are an aside for a very technical reason. But those are the primary, that's the primary flow. And again, that section is to say, be aware of your history. It's at the beginning. It's the first step. It's the first step away from the world. Touch, feel history. The second stage is we sit down and we learn Torah. We take a section of the Torah, Arami Oved Avi, and we study it. We study it together. And this is a stage that teaches us historical participation. Because two things. Number one, the act of Torah study is the single act that most clearly makes you a participant in Jewish history. I remember I once had a friend who was a Baal Tshuva, who never learned Gemara before. And after he learned his first session with someone, he came to me and said, Rabbi, I've never experienced anything like that before. Do you know what I felt? Time disappeared. I was sitting at a table, and there at the table, Rabbi Akiva was talking. And then along comes Rashi, centurion, and begins to answer a question on both of them, and then Rashi's grandchildren begin to yell at Rashi, you got it wrong. And then someone else, and I'm sitting there, and they're all talking to each other. And then I have a question, and I'm talking to them too. That's learning Torah. You become a participant in the dialogue. You become a participant. And what we learn, and I'm going to end very quickly, what we learn is also a strange section. If I were to tell you that I'm choosing a section to learn on the Seder night, I would have taken the section dealing with the Pesach sacrifice or the Exodus. But it's not what I do. I take a section from the book of Devarim, comes to a farmer who never experienced leaving Egypt, centuries, a brief summary of history, Arami, Oved Avi, and that's what I learned, his formula. And you have to ask yourself, why am I taking a secondary source? Why don't I take, if I'm taking a Torah source to learn at the Seder, bring me a source from the Exodus itself? And there are lots of answers, but I'll tell you the one that I believe is real. Something happens in that farmer's formula. It's amazing. He starts by saying, wandering Arameans were hurt by, and it depends how you translate that. And they went down. Vayerdu, they went down to Egypt. And they were worked hard. Vayanu osanu. And then all of a sudden it switches from them to me. They tormented us. They made us work. In that split second, what's the farmer doing? He's participating in history. In that split second, the farmer, centuries after the Exodus, is saying what happened to them happened to me. And that's why I think you choose that section to learn, because that's a section of historical participation. And then finally, the last thing, and this will end with, Rabban Gamliel says you can't fulfill your obligation at the Seder night unless you talk about Pesach, Matzah, and Morar. That's kind of strange. Those seem to be what are visual tools, not the essence of the story. Can I tell the story without mentioning the word Morar? So why do I have to talk about these symbols? So I believe what Rabban Gamliel is saying, you come to the third stage, and that's historical perpetuation. The way you hand down history, the way you hand down Jewish law, is through tangible, unchangeable mitzvot. It says in the Shema, love God, dot, 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 ukshartem lios al yadecha. Put on tefillin. Why? Because I can teach my child to love God, but the way he or she will love God will be very different from me, because they're very different people and they'll be living in different times. But the tefillin that my son and my grandson will put on, that's the same. And it's the same tefillin as the tefillin we found at Mitzada. So you want to perpetuate Judaism? You can't just hand down ideas. You can't just hand down beautiful thoughts. Oh, that's important. You have to. Those are essential. Handing down the ritual without the thought is empty. But you also have to hand down Pesach, Matzah, and Morar. And that way, V'higadeto l'bincha becomes real. You're going to teach your child, and now you're ensuring not just that this Seder was meaningful, but that there's going to be a Seder tomorrow that will be meaningful as well. So what you see here, if you look carefully, and if you want, again, my Haggadot are on sale, the Haggadot outline this very clearly in the text. You can see very clearly how the text takes us on this journey from being aware of history to participating to perpetuating. And then we finally can say, B'chol dar v'dar, now we've finished. And we are where we need to be. And that's the highest level of the Seder. The highest level of the Seder is feeling part of history and feeling the contribution that you must make to that history. So we've seen that there are three global levels: mitzvot, experiencing one moment of history, and finally injecting ourselves into the historical process. Those are the vision, that's the vision of the Seder. That's what it's all about. I thank you very, very much for your attention and for coming. It's wonderful to speak to a live audience again. It really makes a difference. Thank you.